Applied Mathematics and Physics and Astronomy. And I work with Achim at Applied Mathematics, Rob at Physics, and Thomas and Ray at the IQC. So, first of all, I want to say my apology, because this talk is going to be a bit of a bundle of many things, right? Nothing concrete, nothing very specific, but you already have seen many, many really good talks. And we just have a really classy speaker, that was Carlos. So after that, I think that everything can be forgiven, because I'm not going to be as good as he is. So anyhow, it doesn't matter if I do it that bad, right? So basically, I usually start my talk saying what relativistic quantum information is, or trying to give my version of what relativistic quantum information is. But I don't think that I need that today. So basically, what you guys might be thinking about is like, okay, some of you are this. So this is very, very neat. The idea is okay, it's distracting, right? But what happens? Can you give some experiments? Can you do some stuff actually involving gravity and quantum stuff, or space-time structure and quantum stuff? Well, we've already seen some very interesting talks. For example, Carlos just told you about this extracting past-future correlations out of the quantum vacuum, right? Which is extremely interesting, I guess. So there have been some other talks, some other interesting talks. For example, you've seen
Jason's and Andre's talks also. This work that we did with David Bruski, also in work in preparation. There's also something that I'd like to mention regarding that, so I'm not going to be insisting on that. There's another paper by Miguel Montero and Marco Del Rey, in which, using this model that was introduced in the first paper that Andre explained, basically we explore different kinds of states that the state that Jason studied, basically single photon states. And we find some interesting effects considering localized detectors as well, projective detectors, in which, for example, we have non-monotonicity of entanglement behavior with acceleration, depending on the reference frame, right? So just to let you know that if you're interested in that, you can also check that. Okay. There have been other very interesting talks, right? There have been, or there are going to be some interesting talks. David Bruski told you about entanglement resonances using boxes, which is quite interesting. Nikolai Fries is going to tell you about something similar related to that tomorrow. Anthony Lee told us also how to deal with localized with detectors. Tim Roth is going to talk about he's going to talk about homodyne detection. Thomas is going to talk about experimental satellites, which is the next speaker after me. So all of them are proposals that are close to the experimental world, or as close as we can, okay? So all of them, in the past, people working in our field just considered very idealized scenarios, so most of us did. Some others didn't, but most of us did, right? Now there's a series of works. I'm not mentioning everyone here because it's just the ones that I had in mind, but I'm, of course, forgetting many people here. People is focused on giving proposals in which things are localized, things are well-behaved, things can be, in principle, constructed, or they model reasonably some laboratory settings, right? So what can I say about that? Well, I can tell you about some works in which we did some kind of ready-to-experiment stuff to try to detect quantum effects of gravity. So I'm going to sketch some of the proposals only. I won't go into many detail. But for example, first one is this proposal that I have with Yvette Fuentes and Rothman about using geometrical phases to detect the Unruh effect by means of atomic interferometry. So it's an application of quantum optics. Yes, some techniques extracted from quantum optics to try to detect the Unruh effect. So there have been many people here talking about the Unruh effect. We've seen how what the Unruh effect is. So basically, you can understand it as, okay, it's a thermal response of a accelerated detector when coupled to the vacuum state of the field as described by an inertial observer, right? So basically, that's the basic idea. We have a free-falling observer that sees the vacuum state of the field at the same time, looking at the same state of the field. An accelerating observer sees a thermal bath whose temperature is proportional to the acceleration, right? Problem with that is that the effect is extremely small. So it's really a nice theoretical work by Billundrew and some other, like Stephen Hawking, Fulin, Davis. Problem is, well, this is the cornerstone, the most important prediction, or one of the most important predictions of quantum field theory in Gauss spacetimes. But the effects are so small that there have been no experiments so far showing anything about that kind of effect. There are some analogies, some ideas, but still, the consensus is that no one has still given a reasonable proof of that effect, experimentally speaking, right? So what's this proposal about? So first of all, let me introduce very briefly and very sketchy
what this geometrical phase business is. So basically, the amount that we have Hamiltonian that depends on time through a set of parameters that are themselves dependent on time, right? So now imagine that those parameters vary on time in a cyclic and adiabatic way, right? So basically, they vary slowly and they close trajectories in the space of parameters, right? So if these two hypotheses are correct, then your state evolves to basically the same state, right? It's evolving very slowly and the interaction is not very strong, but it acquires some dynamical phase and may acquire some geometrical phase depending on the characteristics of your interaction, right? So basically, that's a very well-developed formalism to compute these geometrical phases in the standard path integral formalism. But the main idea that I want to transmit with this part of the talk is that the detector moving through space-time acquires a global geometrical phase, right? So a scheme of that, basically we have sort of, this is the schematic of the Hamiltonian, right? So that detector has some phases here, right? That is dependent on the point of the space-time in which the detector is. I'm considering here a point like detector. So basically, that detector moves through space-time, and as the detector moves, we start in the ground state of the detector, right? And then we let this detector evolve. As it moves, this phase, this parameter here, change with time. And in the end, we can prove that there is a non-trivial geometric phase after some time of evolution if some hypotheses are fulfilled. Okay. So the idea here is that we require that we need the weak adiabatic condition, right? So we need, if the detector starts from the ground state, right, it evolves to the ground state at the time t. Okay. So in the case of an inertial detector, this is very, very, very easy to verify, because if you evolve some time and the time is not extremely small, you are quite sure that the probability of getting the detector excited is very small. So what happens if we consider accelerated detectors? Then we will have the Unruh effect. It's not as trivial as saying that in the vacuum the detector won't click. If the detector accelerates, the detector may click. But if it clicked, we didn't need any kind of elaborated thing of very fast thing to detect it. Basically, we will take a look at the detector and we'll say, okay, there's the Unruh effect. Problem is that it doesn't click. So that means that the probability of the detector getting excited is still very small. So the weak adiabaticity condition is fulfilled. You can actually check it rigorously. You can do the calculation and see that this guy should be much smaller than 1, and it's order 10 to the minus 10 for the values that we use for the results, right? So basically, what we're saying is that we can use the standard formalism to compute the very phase acquired after a cycle of adiabatic evolution. And it's quite easy to show that the very phase acquired is the same for any inertial observer. Well, not surprising. The phase dependent on time is a logarithm variant thing. So it's basically the x dot k. So that is not dependent it's invariant, the Lorentz transformation. So different inertial observers would see similar variation of that phase. So that Hamiltonian, the variation of the Hamiltonian with respect to time would be similar, right? However, it depends on the acceleration due to the Unruh effect. So basically, it depends on acceleration. In general, it depends on the trajectory. But if you choose to get a uniformly accelerated trajectory, then you can show that this is connected directly to the Unruh. I mean, I'm not going to go into details here, sorry about that. But the fact that the state of the field is thermal, right, is giving you the geometrical phase, right? So basically, what we propose here is, okay, so let's set up an atomic interferometry experiment in which we have two paths. In the atomic interferometry, one of the paths is subjected to some potential fall, that will accelerate any atom that goes through that arm, right? On the other one, any atom that goes through the other one will go inertial, right? So then we throw an atom into that, and then we have an splitting. We split the atom into trajectories, one which is accelerated, one which is inertial. So the result, the title says, is I'll let it go to that. So basically, we need to sustain accelerations of 10 to the 16 g for 10 nanoseconds. Well, yes, I'm not saying that it's going to be easy. That's brutal. That's a lot of acceleration. Of course, I'm not saying that it's going to be easy to detect, right? But the previous best result of direct detection of the Unruh effect needed this acceleration and sustained for longer than a second, right?
Well, the very famous aspect here is a scalable phenomenon, as they are all the procedures to detect neural effect directly that. So it depends on the frequency you tune with, too, right? So instead of using, we did those calculations for atoms with a gap of gigahertz. So if instead of gigahertz, we, for example, take megahertz, then you need only acceleration of 10 to the 16 g. So basically, it's linear with frequency, right? Another really good feature of this is that the difference of phase accumulates. So basically, we can just let these guys go. Yeah, we can wait for a while. So basically, we can make this experiment last longer. And if we wait for microseconds, we achieve the maximum phase, basically. So we can see the optimal interference pattern. And which is even better, the phase is independent of the acceleration sign. So if you actually alternate a path of acceleration, positive acceleration, and negative acceleration, in the end, when you arrive to the screen in which you are making these two trajectories interfere, the atoms going the components of the atoms going in the two trajectories will arrive to the screen with the same speed. That's important because the difference of speed, because those accelerations are quite relativistic, so the atoms when they arrive to the screen are sort of relativistic. A difference of speed in two atom beams that you make interfere impacts the visibility of the interference pattern. So it is really good to have them arriving with the same relative speed, right? So the message here in RAL is basically that we use numerical phases and interference to measure the Unruh thermal state, to measure the Unruh effect by detecting this thermal state of the field. So it is a straightforward idea I won't tell you about, but this is kind of a spin-off of something that is relativistic quantum information, which is great because something good about we with our work in RQI, we know that we borrow in things that people know from other fields and using them here. So it is good to know that there are other fields just producing material for you to do some new stuff, right? Well, yeah, RQI produced these techniques, and these techniques can be used to build a quantum thermometer that is, in principle, doesn't require thermalization, and that's a really good advantage because it's really precise and it's much faster and it goes beyond the classical use of thermometry. But that's another thing, I'm just advertising, right? And I won't tell you about it. So that's for another topic. Another thing that is another field or part of the field that is really promising is the field of quantum simulations, right? So I'm going to talk about this work that I did with Marco de Reagan and Diego Porras at the University Complutense in Madrid. And, you know, why quantum simulate those stuff, right? Well, to begin with, because it's a nice way to observe an analog to gravitational system or things that scenarios that are very difficult to reproduce in the lab. We can do analogs that have the same mathematical behavior, and it is nice to see what happens if in reality everything works. Of course, if it works, that means that the maths are right. So, yeah, but it's nice to happen anyhow. I mean, it's a curious thing to find analogy between different theories. No, as the string theories, for example. If it is nice or not to have analogy between different theories. But there's also more than that, right? I mean, maybe that doesn't justify itself going and looking to quantum simulations, right? But computing things with accelerated atoms is extremely difficult. Hamiltonians dependent on time, perturbative analysis, what if you put a number of detectors, complexity grows very, very quickly, right? So we can actually use, while we know how to reproduce that, we can actually use quantum simulators to solve computations that we cannot solve analytically or numerically. So computers cannot write to that. So there are some really inspiring previous results. There's a really nice one by people that is here, basically. So Paul Alsin, some of the people, including Jörg Milburn. And this is about similar things, accelerated atoms simulating ion traps. It's very similar to what we do. I will spell out the differences with this proposal. And there's a nice proposal by Minicucci about simulating cosmological scenarios, so expanding universal scenarios in similar settings, right? So, yeah, again, same thing. Just consider how difficult it is to model a lattice of spins, right? So basically, using this is the K computer, which is not built yet, is a project. It's going to be the most powerful computer ever built. It's going to be in Japan. And basically, what this guy can do, this huge guy can do, is solving things, solving systems, spin lattices with interactions to all the in all the lattices, right? Of arbitrary interactions for smaller, less than 40 spins, right? So yeah, if we want to model a three-dimensional cube, right, of 7 by 7 by 7 spins, that takes more variables than the number of protons in the universe. So you can see how things scale with, but that's an old one.
I mean, this is well known by probably all of us, that things in quantum mechanics scale exponentially with the dimension of the Hilbert space of the quantum system we want to describe. So similar things happen in when considering accelerated atoms, and I will go to that by the end of that section. So, yeah, okay. So this setting, very briefly, is we consider, just to let you know, an accelerated quantum emitter in a cavity, right? Yeah. We can write the effective Hamiltonian for that single mode interacting with a cavity, right? Like this. This is a well-known Hilbert Hamiltonian, only seen by the perspective of an accelerated observer, written in its proper time, right? So, this has been explained before, so I won't insist in too much on that, right, basically. But how do we model this system in a, for example, a trapped ions or similar system? So, in trapped ions, we have a Coulomb crystal, for example, and that Coulomb crystal has some vibrational modes. The quanta of that vibrational modes field, right, you know, the phonons in that network, is basically a scalar field. So we have the first component, we have a scalar field for the Unruh de Wien detector model, right? What about our qubits, our detector, right? We can use the internal state of ions trapped in that lattice, basically. So we take, for example, calcium like that, and there are two levels that we use to spin up one, spin down a zero. And there are really nice ways to read out those atoms. Everything can be controlled. We can measure not only carry out local measurements, we can also measure correlators directly. So it's a system that is very well known. So the idea here, basically, let me summarize it. So we actually light the ions, right, with two laser seeds, right? So we induce this interaction, this kind of interaction, laser-atom interaction. So this interaction, effectively, what it does, I won't insist in the details, it couples the internal state of the ions with the vibrational fields. Well, there's a pictorial way to see this. So basically, I have a laser that is beaming, and I can understand that kind of stimulate radiation and emission in the atoms. On the other hand, the atoms are vibrating, so the movement affects kind of the wavelength that they see. Well, it makes sense, I guess, that we can couple effectively the internal state of the atom with the vibrational state of the lattice of ion trapped, right? So basically what we're doing, in simple words, is what is known in the literature as qubit motion coupling. We're coupling the vibrational field in the lattice with the internal degrees of freedom of the atom. And the kind of Hamiltonians that we can reproduce can be an Unruh de Wien detector, provided that we control the phases of the lasers with which we are lighting up the atoms. And that's possible, that's very easy actually. If you ask experimentalists on that, they tell you that they can do that. They can have, we want an exponential dependence like that. Well, we can do it, in principle. Okay, so in principle, that can be, it is doable, right? So let me compare with the previous proposal. First of all, what's the novelty here, right? So we actually can be exported to different systems. Like, for example, in the paper, we talk about CKQED, how to do the same thing in CKQED. But in principle, it could be extended to other systems with, in principle, not too much difficulty, right? But what's the difference with the previous work? So basically, just, I guess that they can correct me if I'm mistaken, because we have the authors here. So for this paper by Paul Alsin, they need to modify the trapping potential, right? And I don't see how that can be, for example, scalable. Maybe it is, but it's just that I don't see that it can be easily scalable. Whereas, for example, here they modify the amplitude and frequency of the laser creating the sidebands that they use to couple to build this effective Hamiltonian. In our case, we just need to control the phase of the laser that I'm beaming the atoms, and in principle, it's a setting that is scalable, and the scalability only depends on your ability to trap and control ions. So in principle, it can be up to, for using state-of-art figures, experimental figures, we can safely say that we can do it with 10 atoms, for example, quite easily. So, another thing that we discussed in that paper is the connection, which is, I think, interesting on our field. Basically, there's a connection, we discovered a connection between some non-equilibrium physics result and the accelerated atoms, accelerated Unruh de Wien detector. So basically, it's an all-known result that when you have, this is the Landau-Singer effect, basically. When you have an atom, right, and whose gap changes with time, if the dependence on time is linear, then and it's interacting with some mode of a field in a cavity, for example, there's of course some level crossing, and depending on the speed with which these two levels cross, the probability of transition can be solved analytically. And actually, that's good, because this is a complicated problem in general. It's a time-dependent Hamiltonian. Well, here we don't have a linear dependence of the gap of the atom, but we do have an effective time dependence of the separation between the atom's gap and the different modes in the cavity. So we have we can describe this as an avoided level crossing problem, right? So depending if the acceleration is big or not, the transition is adiabatic or non-adiabatic, right? So in the case that it is non-adiabatic, it's exactly the Landau-Singer model, right? So basically, Landau-Singer, you see there's a linear dependence on time of the gap, of the difference of energy. Whereas here we have some exponential dependence, but there are some regions where we can linearize this, and we can obtain we can use the Landau-Singer result, Landau-Singer effect results, to predict what's going to happen to the Unruh that we detector. So in blue, we have the numerical results for the Unruh that we detector that we are simulating, and in red, we have the analytical results for the Landau-Singer effect. As you can see, there are regimes where we can perfectly explain with the Landau-Singer effect what is going on with a relativistically accelerated detector. I think that's nice because it's showing a connection between some non-equilibrium physics results, giving us some analytical tools to use in something very different, which is relativistically accelerated detectors. That's really good. But then the most important thing here, let me just put it this way, the most important thing here is that, okay, so what's the point on doing all those simulations? There's something which is very interesting. We know people who do condensed matter, right? The DK supervolume transition. We know that when we have many atoms coupled to the same quantum field, imagine that we couple them to the same field mode, for example, many atoms. There's a phase transition if you play with different parameters, right? In which the atoms no longer respond individual atoms; they respond coherently to the radiation, and the probability of getting one of the atoms excited is actually growing linearly with the number of atoms that are coupled. Those sorts of collective phenomena, what they're doing is amplifying both the probability of detecting a quanta of the field when you have many atoms, and the probability of emitting a quanta to the field when you have many atoms, compared to the individual settings where you have different atoms which behave in an incoherent way. So, can we actually hope, if we want to detect the Unruh effect, then we can obtain something similar? For example, imagine that I get an array of atoms and I accelerate the whole array of atoms. So if I get coherence and those some strange, probably difficult things, but is there any point in doing those? So should I expect a phase transition such that I see some collective phenomena that actually amplifies the probability of detecting the Unruh effect by, instead of considering one detector, I just accelerate a bunch of detectors while keeping control and coherence among them? Well, we don't know. Why? Because the calculations are so difficult. You know, computers can handle about 5 qubits with the Unruh that we detector undergoing constantly accelerated trajectories, given that it is time-dependent Hamiltonian, right? A non-perturbative calculation in a computer, right, can handle, and I'll tell you about my experience, and these guys grow exponential, so what happens in my computer is going to happen with yours probably in a few qubits more, if you have more powerful computers. So 5 qubits is just the limit of practicity. From 4 to 5, it grows from some hours to several days. So above that, we cannot go. But if we have a trapped ion network, basically a Coulomb crystal of trapped ions with 10, 15, 20 ions, we can let it evolve, and in no time, we have the result of that computation. We can see if there's some phase transition if we reproduce all the mathematics of the accelerated detector, right? So that's the point of doing that. So we can explore regimes non-perturbatively, which is very important, because in RQI, there are many effects that are coming out from first-order perturbation theory, but are some others that appear in second and above. So it is important we can have non-perturbative calculations in regimes that are currently unexplored in our field. So I think that's a nice point to defend or try to sell the quantum simulators. Okay, just to mention very briefly, some other work that are in preparation, like considering the Astor experiment and the Unruh effect, right? So imagine that I put, you all probably know the Astor experiment. We try to measure a Bell inequality, right? Test a Bell inequality. So basically, we have this is a beam splitter, a polarized beam splitter, and we are able to move these angles here. And you know, the usual way, you play with the observables and the measurements that you do, and you know that if you have a local realistic theory, you always have that. And then if you have quantum mechanics, you have this number. And this has been proved in the lab, in principle. There are some loopholes and stuff, but in principle, it's accepted that it's been proved experimentally, right? So now imagine, well, the assumption here is that when we generate an entangled state here, we have a photon that, if the photon is detected here, due to the entanglement that the detector has, that the state has, the photon will be detected here, but not here, right? Because some sort of, we can say, collapses to the state in which the detector has plus polarization here, plus polarization here. So we know that if those angles are the correct ones, if we have a click here, we have a click here, I will never detect anything here. But what if the detectors are actually accelerating, are in motion? Well, if they're in motion, they can give false clicks, like dark counts, but not quite dark counts, something else, right? Like a noise coming from the accelerating detector. So basically, it could happen that one of the photons goes this way, the other one goes this way. This one is detected, this one is not detected, and the other guy clicks due to the Umbro noise, detecting the Umbro effect, okay? So we have two sources, two differences with the aspect experiment if we consider accelerating detectors, right? First difference, this is the obvious one, source of local noise. So if all the detectors are accelerating, they will detect some thermal state, and that introduces noise in our Bell tests, okay? Which is, in principle, what it's doing is degrading the S that, in principle, you will measure like 2 square root 2. Well, due to this local noise, you will detect something more than that. You will see 2 square root 2 minus epsilon, right? But you don't win too much doing that. Basically, that's the same as detecting the Umbro effect. Using some other settings without entanglement, maybe you win something because you're detecting correlations. But why not use classical correlations and forget about entanglements if you want to detect local noise only, right? There's something else that is related with what Carlos told you, and many other people told you, which is the vacuum state of the field contains some correlations. And if I accelerate two detectors, there might be that some of the detectors, if they're interacting with the same field in a coherent way, some of the clicks of the detectors are not uncorrelated. Some of them are actually correlated clicks. This is a second order effect, right? So the correlated noise, which in principle is small, has a dependence on acceleration. So basically it's modifying the 2 square root 2 detected in the aspect experiment. These are preliminary results anyhow, so don't believe it completely, right? Just get the idea. So basically what we obtain is d is equals 2, right, in our case. So let me put it this way. The probability of detecting the Umbro effect alone without using the Bell experiment is something that goes like hyperbolic tangent of this guy, right? So in principle, well, this is the correction, by the way. I don't know why I'm saying that. That's the correction. So basically, if you do the thing looking for correlations in an aspect-like experiment, you obtain a square here. Well, the problem with all those settings is that when acceleration... So you have something like that. This is acceleration, right? And this is the famous or infamous hyperbolic tangent that is everywhere, almost everywhere. So basically, there's some critical acceleration. Beyond that, you will detect the Umbro effect just looking at the detector. Below that, you don't detect anything, and this is very sharp. So adding powers into that hyperbolic tangent contribute to spread a little bit what's going on here and makes it easy, in principle, to access this transition point. So it is kind of promising because we think, or we have the suspicion, that this d has to do with the dimension of the maximal entangled state used. So maybe using a different dimensional, like a three-dimensional entangled state, we can improve that, okay? But this is just work in progress, so don't pay too much attention. And just to finish, I'd like to do, so Thomas is going to talk about this satellite-based experiments. It's a really interesting stuff. Actually, real experimentalists know how to do some things to test quantum mechanical stuff related to relativity, and this is real. This is no longer a problem of, like, for example, as we have, for example, Juan and I and some others have about, can we localize this thing? Well, no, they're doing the experiment, so that's a different thing. They can do stuff, right? We won't discuss about if we can localize the thing or are there some tales that actually spoiling causality. No. They can do that. They can do it. They can do experiments. So I'm going to talk about three small pieces. Thomas is going to tell you about the rest, but there's just some ideas that what you can do having satellites, for example. One thing that is particularly interesting is the Bell test with detectors in relative motion. So why is that? Okay, you have relativistic motion, you know, Well, people normally understand that entanglement or result of these correlations that appear in entanglement. There's some, I can call it naive, I guess, description of quantum collapse, right? So I have 0, 0, plus 1, 1. So if I measure a 1 here, I know that the other guy will measure a 1. So I'm kind of collapsing the state, and then in the future, this other guy will measure the state, and then he will obtain a 1. But we know that this is naive, right? But it's kind of useful and still being used in practice, right? This kind of picture. But what happens when we include observers with different relative motion? Well, things are not simultaneous anymore, and the concept of what happened before and what happened after, when you consider observer that are space like separated, is observer dependent. So for example, for this observer, right, he carries out the measurement first, for example, and then this other guy carries out the measurement after. So he will say, I collapse the state and you will find something. But it is completely symmetric. This guy will say, I measure first, and then in the future, you will measure something because I collapse the state, right? Yeah, I want to think that. So it would be really nice to test that in an experiment and see what's going on there. I mean, of course, I have to say that there are some interpretations of quantum mechanics that are completely free from that apparent paradox, like ensemble interpretation, Cochin history, many worlds, whatever you prefer. But certainly Copenhagen interpretation completely fails to explain what's going on here, right? So what we can do with low Earth orbit satellites, basically, those satellites have a relative speed among them. Well, imagine one going this way in the orbit, the other one going the other way, right? The relative speed among them is about 15 kilometers per second, right? So the time shift between these two guys, to say, I did it first, you did it after, that, huh? Is of order of 166 picoseconds per kilometer, right? So basically, the minimal separation, just considering current technology, the minimal separation that we will need between these two satellites to be able to at least theoretically address the experiment is 60 to 1,000 kilometers, right? That's kind of the real thing. So what's the maximum separation we can get with these satellites? Well, it's actually order 1,500 kilometers, which is great. So that means that we can actually do this test, right? The requirement of, you need to be very careful with synchronized clocks of the guys in the orbit and also the generation of your entangled pair. The demands here are of order of 250 nanoseconds, which in principle, Thomas will correct me in the next talk, is attainable with current technology, or at least state of art technology, right? Another one, so fundamental test of quantum mechanics. I know, and Carlos will say, and he's right, that if we want to test, for example, carry out some tests about the Fermi problem, or for example, extracting space-like entanglement, in principle, we need to make sure that things are space-like separated, and Carlos can say, no, come on, you only need to make sure that you can disconnect the interaction afterwards and wait for a while, and you knew that while the systems were interacting, right, they were space-like separated, and after that they weren't anymore because they were interacting, so I don't mind. I mean, I can just read out the states, free evolution, so I don't mind too much. That's correct, and I agree with him. But if you ask some people working in quantum foundations of physics, they will tell you, well, but I don't accept that. There's a loophole there, because although you are describing your system very well and you know that, in principle, in nature, we know that there are things that you may not know about that may propagate at the speed of light, right? So the only way to make sure that we are space-like separated and there's nothing spooky going on, if relativity is correct, is making sure that all the process, including the measurements, are carried out during the space-like separation period, right? So that's an obvious application of satellites. Increasing the distance between these detectors, of course, things are more difficult because you need to keep coherent interaction with same of the field, things like those, but on space that's easier than on Earth. That's what I mean. So it's not easy, but it's easier to engineer those long-range interactions, right? But you know, if you are able to increase the distance, if you do the thing like within the solar system, you can do it. I mean, you can safely say, okay, I'm measuring here, and all the measurements, the system was space-like separated. So that's another application of satellite-based experiment. So there are many. So this is my last my penultimate slide, basically. So basically, there are some other things studied, like gravitational induced entanglement correlations that some people here know about better than me. So for example, using microgravity to assist the very phase atomic interferometry that may be interfered by the Earth gravity, because we know the sensitivity should be that high, right? Also, using entanglement harvesting, that we also will hear a talk about that in the future. Next, I don't know if tomorrow or on Thursday, I'm not sure. But basically, we can use that to probe the space-time. So if we have satellites, can we maybe think of an experiment, even in theory, which we can probe and do maybe some cosmology out of that? Some people would argue no, because the separation, the characteristic length between these two satellites is not comparable to the Hubble length. Okay, great, but let me do the numbers and let's see what happens, right? Maybe we are able to distinguish it better than current experiments, so look at some correlation somewhere else. Also, there are some quantum gravity tests, for example, using satellites to give bounds to the Lorentz invariant diffusion of polarization. And there are some others that are really important, and I don't want to leave without mentioning, although Thomas is possibly talking about that, which are the quantum technological applications of that. Of course, we can do quantum teleportation via satellite, satellite-based QKD, orbital quantum repeaters. So basically, we're enabling. We know that we cannot communicate too far away using optical fibers, because the maximum length that we can achieve is like 100 kilometers, right? Same with open air, with doing an atmospheric distribution of entanglement. We have the same problems. We have the maximum distance that we can achieve with current technology. So for different reasons, one is the leakage of the optical fibers, and the other one is basically the noise that you introduce when you're doing the thing atmospherically, plus dispersion, right? So using satellites, in principle, they are not too far away. They can be like 60 kilometers away. So you can definitely do an atmospheric entanglement distribution or QKD, or you can use those satellites to as quantum repeaters. So I don't want you to forget that this is going to generate technology. And I wouldn't be surprised if in 10 years there's someone using that commercially, or at least claiming that they use it commercially, right? So, okay, that's all. So basically, just I want to end this talk just saying one phrase, like, it is time for us to think of realistic. Yeah, by realistic, I mean, by realistic, I don't mean not having causality problems or things like those that I'm very interested about. I mean, okay, let's do physically feasible and technologically achievable things, right? And let's prove the people that our field is going to produce some results that we can prove in the lab, and who knows, even generate quantum technologies that people don't know about yet, right? So yes, that's all. Thank you very much for listening.